Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America's great immigrant innovator, Nikola Tesla, helped give us everything from the alternating current that comes out of our walls to the whirring motors in our computers, even the sound of my voice coming across the radio. He was a near wizard in the 1880s, putting on great displays of electrical current surging through his body to light a bulb. His rival, Thomas Edison, eclipsed Tesla's fame. But now, at a time when America is hungry for world-changing innovation, Tesla is back in style. There's a car company named after him. His name shows up in movies, on TV, in video games. Tesla is hot. This hour on Point, Nikola Tesla and America's hunger and need for innovation today. Plus, in this hour, we'll touch base with Davos and hear the expectations for Apple's hot new product in the spotlight today. You can join the conversation. Do you know the Nikola Tesla story? Who's the best model for American innovators now? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me first today is Daniel Michaels, correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. His recent page one piece about Nikola Tesla's comeback in popular culture, techie culture anyway, was headlined, "Long Dead Inventor Nikola Tesla is Electrifying Hip Techies." He joins us from Brussels. Daniel, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Hi, Tom.
So 1880s, arrival of Thomas Edison. He was a Serbian, highly educated in Europe before he came to work with Edison in the United States. But they broke up. They broke apart pretty quickly. And he championed what, Daniel?
Alternating current, which was seen as a better way to transmit electricity than direct current, which is what you get out of a battery, and what Edison was championing.
Direct current could only reach customers, for a mile or so around a plant. AC, alternating current, really made possible cheap, ubiquitous electricity all over distance. And it's Tesla's push.
Exactly. And what he did, among other things, was figure out how to make a motor that could work off alternating current. Because until then, the problem was, as I understand it, and I'm not an electrical engineer, is the motor would go back and forth, which is not very good for a motor. And he figured out a way to make things work and develop it on a large scale. Then he did it first on a limited scale, then helped build the hydroelectric plant designed and build the hydroelectric plant at Niagara Falls. And that was really where one of the things that really got it rolling.
Not to mention the coil at the guts of radio. He was deep in that as well. He was a great showman. But he didn't end up with the same kind of, he ended up penniless at the end, but he didn't build the kind of empire that Thomas Edison did. Why not?
Fundamentally different approach to things. Edison was in many ways a tinkerer. He wasn't a theoretician the same way as Tesla, but he had a whole stable of people working for him, and they churned through ideas and worked really hard at them. Hours and hours testing different things, a very industrial approach to coming up with new products, and very much focused on the product. Things like finding the right filament for the incandescent light bulb. Tesla was more interested in pursuing ideas, also with an end result in mind, but didn't have the infrastructure around him and wasn't as immediately commercial in his approach.
And they were very big ideas, maybe bigger than Edison's ultimately. Why is Nikola Tesla so popular again today? What's the evidence of his popularity, Daniel?
Well, the evidence is, as you mentioned, there's the Tesla Roadster electric car. I just saw the movie Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, and in it, the hero scientist has a poster, Nikola Tesla, rock star scientist. So any number of things like this. He makes an appearance in the recent movie The Prestige, where David Bowie plays him. So you can't get much cooler than that.
He's out in a new video game. He's a kind of a hovering gadget guru wizard within, what's it called, Dark Void.
Dark Void, yes, exactly, yeah. And his persona is a bit malleable because he, except for a handful of experts, most people who know his name don't really know what he did. They know that he was brilliant. They know he was important. But he's kind of hard to nail down, and that makes him a kind of a vessel in which people can put their ideas. And, you know, oh, we got something cool equals Tesla. Whereas Edison invented things that people know. I mean, like, you know, the wax cylinder phonograph. You know, it's our, you know, great grandparents era. So Edison, you know, in contrast, very much associated with particular things and particular eras.
Almost a sci-fi angle to Tesla, or it can be attributed to him because the thoughts were so big. Not everything we take for granted that he worked on and thought about, and so he's out there in the popular culture in a big way. Do you see it as a kind of a sign of, I don't know, techies wanting to break through, wanting to think big, as Tesla thought big?
He definitely thought big. He thought about radical change. I mean, he's very much an out-of-the-box thinker. Everyone was saying alternating current can't be done. He said, I can do it. Many other things like that. He had ideas that were well ahead of their time. In the 1880s or 90s, he built radio-controlled boats when radio itself was just in its infancy. So he had ideas for what essentially later developed into Star Wars defense, particle beams, things like that. So as you say, a very science fiction aspect to him. He also was kind of a lone wolf. So in an era where people are kind of fed up with corporate management, that he was seen as very much outside the establishment. And I think that is a major attraction to him.
Daniel Michaels in Brussels today. Thank you very much for joining us, Daniel. Thanks for the article and thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Daniel Michaels writes for The Wall Street Journal. Nikola Tesla, who would have thought it? He's back in popular culture. Sanctuary is a TV show on the Sci-Fi Channel. Jonathan Young plays a fictional half-vampire version of Nikola Tesla, no less. In an effort to resurrect an ancient strain of vampires, this Tesla opens a clinic in Mexico. He infects drug-addicted teenagers with a treatment that will turn them into vampires over 30 years. His plan backfires. The teen vampires activate early. They come after Tesla. Oh, boy, it's crazy out there. But here's a scene from it. Nikola Tesla, played by Jonathan Young, confronts the rogue teenage vampires, telling them they've screwed up his plan.
What the hell are you playing at?
Look, this isn't a game. Okay, we both know that.
Don't read me the rule book, Sonny. I wrote it.
What's your problem? And this was your idea, remember?
No. The spontaneous generation of vampires decades ahead of schedule was not my idea. I had a plan, an intricate, ingenious design. And strange as it may sound, it did not involve you blowing away your friends and taking over.
An intricate, ingenious design. And Nikola Tesla is back in popular culture there in the sci-fi TV show Sanctuary. W. Bernard Carlson joins us now from Charlottesville, Virginia. He's professor of science, technology, and society at the University of Virginia. He's currently working on a biography of Nikola Tesla, due out from Princeton Press early next year. His working title is Ideal and Illusion, The Life and Inventions of Nikola Tesla. Bernard Carlson, thanks very much for being here. Bernie.
Very glad to be here. Tom, thanks for having me on.
You've got a serious kind of academic interest in this man. We've got the popular culture feel for him there, but introduce us again. Take it from the top. How would you tell us who was Nikola Tesla?
Well, Tesla was as Dan pointed out, a contemporary of Thomas Edison, and he was one of a whole generation of extremely talented individuals who pushed technology to new limits between 1870 and 1920. And he, in particular, had two major inventions, the alternating current motor that Dan mentioned, which revolutionized the way we use, generate, and consume electricity. It allowed for things like Niagara Falls to be connected to New York City and for people to use electricity for all sorts of things, such as refrigerators or streetcars or what have you. His second big invention, which came after that, the electric motor was in the 1880s, was in the 1890s. Tesla worked long and hard with electromagnetic waves, what we call radio waves today, and his vision was to develop a scheme for broadcasting power around the world using using radio waves.
In other broadcasting words, power, wireless power transmission.
Exactly. And his vision was this: you wouldn't have to have plugs and wires for anything that you used in your house or in your business. That indeed what you would do is simply connect, have an antenna on the top of the house, have a ground connection underneath the house, and that the power would come through the ground up into your house, and you'd be able to have all sorts of new gadgets and things like that.
Why didn't that ever happen, Bernie Colson? Did it turn out to be impossible? Was he dreaming, or we just went another way?
Well, it's a little bit of each, Tom. The first and foremost thing is people today still are actively researching how you might actually have wireless power, and a number of important physicists have been wrestling with this. There's a gentleman at MIT who's looked at the potential for wireless power, but there are some basic physics problems in that basically Tesla thought that the world functioned like a great big water balloon, that if he pushed on one side, the other side of the world would deflect out. And, of course, the world is not a giant, from an electromagnetic standpoint, water balloon. It's actually much more like an ocean, so that if you push on one side or you create waves on the edge of the ocean, say in New Jersey, those waves do not necessarily automatically wind up on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean in Portugal.
Before it was all over, he was out in Colorado Springs, and saying, among other things, that he thought he might have made contact with Martians, I think.
That's right. He spent about 8 months in Colorado Springs studying how to transmit power through the earth, and while he was there, he became convinced that he heard a signal that he could not explain from any terrestrial or other typical source. It was a series of beeps, one beep, two beeps, three beeps. He decided it had to represent intelligent life somewhere else in the solar system, and the reporters decided pretty early on that it ought to be Mars.
This was
the same period that Lowell was working in Arizona and observing the canals that were built on Mars.
Right.
And people saw the canals and said, holy cow, if there are canals on Mars, there must be smart people that built the canals.
Bernie Carlson, stand by. We have to take a short break here. We're talking about Nikola Tesla. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the legendary Edison-era innovator Nikola Tesla and the hunger for a new wave of innovation, American innovation, today. Later this hour, we'll hear from Davos and get a report on expectations for Apple's hot new product being announced today. Bernard Carlson is with us. He's at the University of Virginia. He's coming out next year with a big bio of Nikola Tesla, and I think your timing is going to be great on that. Knows a lot about the man. Listeners, you can join us as well. Bernie, he showed up with 4 cents in his pocket in 1884. I'm reading here a few of his poems in his pocket and calculations for a flying machine. Within what, a year or two, he had made a bundle selling the patent for alternating current to George Westinghouse. Have I got that right?
Absolutely. He's one of the great rags-to-riches stories in American business and technology, that he arrived knowing absolutely no one in New York City in 1884. He had a letter of reference from one of his previous bosses in Europe, where he had worked on Edison electric lighting systems. And the letter said, Dear Thomas Edison, I know of two great men in the world, yourself and this young man who's standing in front of you.
Wow.
I mean, how could you start with you can't go wrong with such a great opening letter.
But where Thomas Edison built companies that built products, Nikola Tesla went in a different way. Describe his style for us.
Well, most of the time that when we think about this exciting period of 1870 to 1920 in American technology, we think of the heroes and the innovators who built big companies, built big operations for either manufacturing goods or providing services. Tesla decided early on that manufacturing was not where his particular strength was, and so he very carefully avoided going into, say, setting up a factory, as Edison did, to make electric lights or phonograph records. Instead, Tesla decided that his big strategy was what I call promotion, which is the idea, the essence of the strategy is that you develop a new technology, you get a certain amount of demonstration that you can do in the laboratory or in public lectures, and then you follow up with a lot of reports in the newspapers and generate excitement. And when the excitement peaks, you sell your patents to the highest bidder, and you let those people take on the hard work of engineering and fully developing the product. Tesla did this once very successfully with the alternating current motor in the 1880s. He had a fabulous business entrepreneur behind him. Mm-hmm. They sold the patents to Westinghouse. Sadly, with the work that he did in radio and when he was racing against Marconi, he never had the same sort of business partner, and so as a result, his ideas about radio were never fully developed.
We've got a question on just that front from Michael in Nashville, Tennessee. Michael, you're on the air with Bernie Carlson.
Hi. I actually heard that he did invent the radio, but it was just something that happened at the United States Patent Office that led to Marconi getting a majority of the credit, or actually all of the credit for this device. And I was wondering if that could be elaborated on.
Bernie Carlson?
Well, Marconi certainly got a number of very strong patents in radio in the period 1899-1905. Tesla, however, had a number of fundamental patents that described his scheme for broadcasting power around the world. Note that it's about broadcasting power, not about broadcasting messages. And those patents date back to 1891-1892. So that indeed, in 1945, when the United States government decided to go after the Radio Corporation of America, RCA, mm-hmm. as a monopoly, they went back and they looked at the patents, and on the basis of the patents, the Supreme Court decision said that the patents that actually really count here are not the Marconi patents, but are indeed the Tesla patents. Now, of course, by then, Tesla is dead. He passes away in 1943, mm-hmm. And the structure of the American radio industry is already set up in a particular way. But if you want to look as to who was first thinking about the right kind of circuits, about the idea of tuning, about making sure that you grounded your radio apparatus, Tesla had all of those ideas early on.
But interesting that he was looking at broadcasting power, as you say, instead of essentially kind of radio telegram. Let me get Anthony in here, if I may, Bernie, from Long Island in New York. Anthony, you're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Carlson and Mr. Ashbrook. Thank you so much for this opportunity. Yeah. Nikola Tesla had worked very close to my home in Shoreham, Wading River, and he had been erecting a tower to provide free electricity to our community. You know, I've always felt that electricity is not an invention but a discovery, and the planet itself acts as a generating motor. It generates huge amounts of electricity just by its cycling throughout the universe. And my point is that electricity, at least from what I understand of Tesla's work, was that he wanted to tap into the planet's sphere, electrical sphere, which provides, you know, if you ever see a lightning storm, from what I understand, one bolt of lightning, I mean, the lightning is always there, but it only reveals itself during certain storms and high humidity levels. But if we could harness the electricity that actually exists around the planet, which is what I believe Tesla was doing in secret, because he had been undermined at every level from the various business leaders in the United States. I mean, as you see, competition is fierce amongst business leaders. And from what I understand, Tesla was far superior to Edison. Another point I would hope that you would discuss is that Mr. Tesla had won the contract to light the World's Fair, and Thomas Edison told him he couldn't use his light bulbs in order to undermine his ability to attend that fair. And from what I understand, overnight he developed the fluorescent light bulb, which is far superior to this day to the incandescent bulb.
Anthony, you are really plugged in. Let us pick it up. That's all terrific. I mean, is it possible that there are stories to mine here, Bernie? Well, I mean, but people are going to be thinking, did he have some alternative energy production means in mind? I mean, he was producing lightning at one point, if I read correctly, or something like it. Do you think Anthony's on to something there? Was Tesla out on the alternative energy frontier?
Tesla is regarded by many people in the alternative energy movement as one of the great heroes and one of the people who pointed a new way of organizing the way that we generate and consume energy. And there certainly is a fundamental charge to the Earth that Tesla was studying. And he did indeed, in studying that and in trying to develop his ideas for wireless power, Tom, generate his own artificial lightning bolts somewhere between 100 and 135 feet long when he was in Colorado Springs. Mm-hmm. He said he indeed probably could have made even bigger lightning bolts, but he was afraid that he'd burn down the wooden barn that he had erected in Colorado mm-hmm. Springs.
Yep.
And he certainly was working on all sorts of important new ideas. He was a great believer in replacing the incandescent light and going to some sort of fluorescent bulb. I have to smile when I see these sort of coiled up new fluorescent bulbs that we're all supposed to install in place of the incandescent lights, because I could show you pictures not of a round spiral but of a square spiral, very similar.
A century ago.
Tesla was promoting over a century ago.
It's pretty amazing. He was his electricity did end up being used at the World's Fair in Chicago, right? I mean,
that's right. The bulb that your previous caller was talking about was actually not designed by Tesla, but indeed by George Westinghouse, who was a big supporter of Tesla and did as much as anybody to promote the development of alternating current in this country. And he's another great forgotten hero. Very interesting man. Never wrote anything down. Carried all of the information about his gigantic business empire in his head. And he's another guy who's worthy of
a
study similar to Tesla.
Now, Tesla was quite a showman. He would stand on stage and let this big current of electricity run through him to light the bulb, right?
That's right. He would have a very large Tesla coil, almost as tall as himself, and he would basically, at the right moment in the show when he had – or the lecture had kind of generated a whole lot of dramatic interest, he would walk up, grab – the terminal of the Tesla coil in one hand, and in his other hand, he would hold up an electric one of his new fluorescent bulbs, and the bulb would just light up brilliantly. And he could take up to I've seen in sources up to about 250,000 volts. Now,
do not try this at home.
Exactly, Tom. Do not try this at home. The way that this works, by the way, is what's called the surface effect, which is if you have a sufficiently high voltage and a sufficiently low amperage current, then the high voltage travels along the skin of your body and goes from one place to another, so it doesn't actually pass through the vital organs such as the heart and basically stop the heart from beating. So believe me, don't try this one at home.
But he knew how to do it. Mark in
Exactly. He knew how to do it.
Mark in Niagara Falls, New York. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
We have a peculiar connection, I think, with Tesla, in that we were the pilot project. The Sholkoff power plant was the pilot project for polyphase AC current. And so I took probably more interest than people do elsewhere in Tesla. And reading in the library, I was given to understand by reading not only his two biographies of him and an autobiography.
Yes.
And a biography of Edison and a biography of J.P. Morgan, that one of the things that put the kibosh on his wireless electricity was, where do you put the meter? It was a bad business model.
Ah, right. How do you get people to pay for it? What about that? Thank you, Mark. What about that, Bernie?
That's a very interesting story that continually circulates, and I have spent a lot of time just recently working through the correspondence between Tesla and Morgan in the period when it's after Niagara, it's from 1900 to 1905, when he's working on the tower that one of your listeners mentioned was built on the north shore of Long Island near what's Shoreham today, at a place that was then known as Wardenclyffe. And lots of people sort of say, oh, well, Morgan pulled the plug, refused to put any more money into the project because he couldn't figure out with Tesla what we would say today is the business model. That is to say, how are we going to actually make money from this project? Mm-hmm. And I would... In my book, I'm going to make two points. One is that Tesla did have a business model that he discussed in correspondence with Morgan. The money was going to actually be made by selling not transmitters. He would own the transmitter, but by selling the receivers. That is to say, you would have a small pocket for messages and for power. For power, it's a little unclear what the receiver would look like, but for messages, he envisioned that people would have a small device in their pockets that would be no bigger than a pocket watch. That was the way he described it, in which you would be able to get the latest news, stock quotations, and believe it or not, he said this in 1904, that you would be able to talk to your friends anywhere around the world without any interference.
A little ahead of his time, maybe.
Well ahead of his time on that. So that was the business model. Now, the reason why Morgan decided to not continue to support Tesla's work on the wireless power station in Long Island has to do with competition and rivals. About the same time that Tesla is working in Long Island, there are a number of other people, Marconi being one, but a third one being Lita Forst, who's later famous for the vacuum radio tube, who set up radio companies and basically sell worthless stock to various people. So it becomes sort of a speculative investment. And at the time that this is happening, 1902, 1903, Teddy Roosevelt has become president, and the first thing that Teddy Roosevelt does when he becomes president is he goes after a giant monopoly. And who's the giant monopoly he goes after? The Northern Pacific Company, that is Northern Pacific Railroad, that is controlled by J.P. Morgan. Mm-hmm. So Morgan wants to have nothing to do with anything that looks like a monopoly or a speculative investment, and that's why he just basically decides not to support Tesla anymore. So it's a really interesting business story, and it's one of the larger lessons that it comes out of this is an interesting question, which is we all want the new technology. We all want the radical technologies, the game changers that, that Dan Michael mentioned in his newspaper story and when you were talking to him a few minutes before. How do we, in the American economy, manage to make sure that the money goes to the people that actually are going to be able to bring about the game changers and not people that are just sort of churning and wasting the money, as in this particular case DeForest was doing with his early speculative company.
We're going to talk about exactly that point with Jason Ponton, editor-in-chief of Technology Review, in just a couple of minutes here. Of course, Tesla faced some derision for some of his claims. He said he could split the earth like an apple. He claimed he had invented a death ray capable of destroying 10,000 airplanes at 250 miles. But he invented a lot that's right out there in the world as well. John in Nashville, you're on the air, John.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. It's great to be on. First off, I'd really like to say that I think it's wonderful that Nikola Tesla is coming back into popular society and stuff, because he really was a visionary ahead of his time. I mean, you just mentioned not long ago, he came up with an idea of basically an iPhone or a cell phone before even phones were even coming into power.
Yes.
I mean, the man was an absolute genius, and I think it'd be really beneficial for American innovators and American technology industries to really delve into his ideas and try to come up with some better, more superior products for the American people.
There's a inspiration in the vision of this guy, but is he the model? Is there a reason that we should be looking to Tesla rather than Edison potentially now, Bernie Carlson, as the model for 21st century innovation, or has old Tom Edison still got the formula?
Well, what I tell my students, and I teach a course to the engineering students at UVA on entrepreneurship, and I say that both Tesla and Edison represent two different models, two different ways of thinking about innovation. Edison's approach was very market-driven. Go out there and discover a market for a new particular product and figure out how to drive down the cost for that particular product. Mm-hmm. So he did that with electric lights. He did that with the phonograph. He did it with motion pictures. Tesla takes a very different approach to innovation. He is what we call in the economics world, he's a supply-side inventor. He's a knowledge-driven inventor. In other words, he looks at new ideas. He was one of the first people in America to read about the discovery of electromagnetic waves by Heinrich Hertz in 1889, and he begins to tinker with that and develop his Tesla coil. But his approach is not to worry about the market, worry about the idea, worry about getting it exactly right and working through the vision and patenting it, and then being the great showman to get everybody excited about that. And so I always tell my students, you need to be thinking about that. At times you want to function like Edison, absolutely. But at other times, you want to function like Tesla. You want to stay close to the technology. You want to fully understand it. You want to develop it as an opportunity. And that, I think, is one of the great lessons that Tesla offers. And we need to be aware that he represents a different path. And that's also why he's popular with people. As Dan Michaels talked about in his article, Tesla is popular with high-tech people and with geeks, and I argue that he's popular, or I would suggest that he's popular, because Tesla represents an alternative path, something that is not relentlessly rational in the sense of being market-driven or being science-driven.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the legendary innovator Nikola Tesla.
and the hunger for a new wave of innovation today. We've been joined by W. Bernard Carlson at the University of Virginia. He's coming out next year with a big biography of Nikola Tesla, the quite astonishing Serbian-born innovator, inventor, who, left all kinds of marvels for us, and some he never quite created, was able to bring to life in his time a century and more ago at the height of his powers. We're joined right now as well from Davos, Switzerland, by Jason Ponton. He's editor-in-chief and publisher of Technology Review in Davos for the World Economic Forum, where he's moderating a panel with technology pioneers. Jason Ponton, thanks very much for joining us today.
Hi there, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. We're talking about a very famous innovator and about innovation in general. And I just wonder how you see the state of American innovation, or for that matter, global innovation today. I'm looking at a survey here from Newsweek Intel, Jason, that says 81% of Chinese believe the United States is staying ahead of China on innovation. But only about half that number of Americans do. About 41% of Americans think that. Americans seem nervous about innovation, and I wonder if that's related, in your mind, to this interest in Nikola Tesla.
Well, the first thing to say, Tom, is that Tesla is somewhat sui generis, right? He is a fantastically inventive engineer and seemingly effortlessly creative. Mm. And he appeals to us as well because he's such a romantic figure in that he's in the world and yet the world knows him not, and he dies unappreciated and
penniless.
In poverty.
Yes.
Yeah, but as Bernie was saying, he is a mythic figure to geeks because he invents a whole series of ideas, or at least conceives them, which could not be made at the time, but which are now used and are tremendously exciting. And for geeks who believe that the world will always embrace a technology that is sufficiently cool, he kind of thrills and inspires them. So, having said that Tesla is this, you know, completely original figure,
yes,
it's also important to note that we live in a miraculous time of innovation, and that there are dozens, hundreds, thousands of inventors and entrepreneurs who might justly say that they are the natural heirs of Tesla.
Are they coming up with the kind of game-changing technologies that Edison and Tesla did? I mean, everybody's waiting, for example, on the alternative energy front. Everyone's desperate for something to come through to save us from this carbon trap. Maybe it's out there, but we're not running our cars entirely on it yet. Is it coming?
Well, that is a great question. The world is faced with pressing problems of which technology is likely the only solution or is the best one. How can we reduce our dependence on hydrocarbons? How can we treat the bottom billion poorest of the world who have no access to diagnostics or therapies? And there are, in fact, smart and wonderful innovators working on those problems right now. Just here at Davos, I chaired a session on the Technology Pioneers of 2010. These are the 24 young entrepreneurs, some not so young, who the World Economic Forum have conceived the ideas that have the greatest chance of transforming the world. Bill Gross was there, who's founded a company called eSolar, mm-hmm, which posits making solar cells cost less than hydrocarbons. Ev Williams of Twitter, famously, was here talking about how people really can talk differently using social networks. There was a wonderful African entrepreneur called Ori Ushahidi, who'd created a mashup technology that allowed Africans or Haitians, people in undeveloped parts of the world, to use simple technologies to mash up Google Maps with events like relief. Where can you find food and water? But there are technologists and innovators working on these problems.
But do you think we have the education system in place and the investment system in place today to produce the big innovative breakthroughs that we now need? Is the whole system working here?
Do you mean America, Tom?
Well, I guess I do, for starters, anyway.
Yeah. So here's an interesting fact. Every year, Technology Review chooses the 35 young innovators under the age of 35 who we think are going to transform the world. And this year, though most of them worked in American universities or corporations, most of them had had their high school or their elementary education outside the United States. Now, at some level, I would say it doesn't matter because innovation is a civilizational global problem that we all have to work on.
Mm-hmm.
And even as a As an American resident, I think it's great that they're coming home to America to found companies and to create economic growth. But at the same time, it's a little disturbing that these innovators had been born in China, in India, in Greece, in the former Soviet Union countries, and that the American education system didn't seem to be producing innovators at the same scale. But Tom, you remember that Nikola Tesla was born in an obscure village. It is now Croatia.
Yes, exactly. Bernie Carlson, when you look around, knowing the Tesla story as well as you do, do you see the U.S. positioned to attract and nurture new Teslas today?
Tom, I certainly do, and I think Jason made a number of good points. It's certainly the case that we have lots and lots of innovators that come to the United States to take advantage of our education system in science and engineering and go on to do exciting and great things. To me, the important thing about the American economy is it supports a variety of different pathways to innovation. I would say that you'd be hard-pressed to identify another industrial economy in the world today that both has pathways by which people can develop and secure investment funding for incremental small innovations, which are always very necessary. Think of the fact that we used to lick postage stamps and today they're self-adhesive. That's a valuable innovation. At the same time, there are people that are willing to bet in the American venture capital market on large-scale disruptive technologies to pull together and basically assemble the teams of engineers and managers and salespeople that are able to do that.
Jason,
and so it's the I think the important thing to focus on is that the American economy is a mixed innovation is a mixed or hybrid innovation system.
Jason, how's that venture capital business doing? It took quite a hit in the economic collapse here. Is it come back? Is it really working these days?
So that's an important point to make. Traditionally, we have looked to venture capitalists to assume much of the risk of funding new companies. Venture capitalists used to say that only 1 in 10 of their companies would really be successful, maybe 3 or 4 would be moderately successful, and the rest would be dreadful failures. But that one company was so successful, it paid for all their other risks. But for the last 5-6 years, almost a decade, the initial public offering of stocks has not returned the same dizzying returns it did for the first 30 years of venture capital. And thus, for the last 10 years, venture capital has either had negative returns or flat returns. And this means that venture capitalists have had a real difficult time funding really game-changing companies. In fact, I can remember 2 which I would say are the equivalents of Cisco, Apple, IBM, Genentech, or venture capital funded companies which have come to market recently. And they're Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah.
All the other companies that, and I suppose A123 Systems here in Boston as well, 3 good companies. All the other companies that we're hearing about at the moment were either funded by the entrepreneurs themselves inside corporations and thus have come to market much more slowly. And also worryingly, they haven't had the thing that venture capitalists can contribute, which is that insight into what the business model might be that will support the new technology. As Bernie was saying, Tesla was a great supply-side inventor, but he didn't have a modern venture capitalist to say, you know, here's how the market might embrace this idea. Edison, by contrast, in his own time, was a fairly futuristic figure in that he was his own venture capitalist well as his owner, his own innovator.
Yeah. Jason Ponton, editor-in-chief and publisher of Technology Review, joining us today from Davos in Switzerland. We're very happy to have you with us. Thank you for joining us, Jason.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Bernie Carlson, so many callers we're not going to get to in this hour, and I'm sorry for it. Here's the head of a laser company saying that it's based, here he is working in the 21st century on, lasers based on Tesla's technology. Tesla's still very relevant to him. Here's another inventor who pushed forward the alternating current out of Augusta, Georgia. Very grateful to Tesla. If Nikola Tesla were around today, what do you think he'd make of the environment for pushing the envelope, Bernie?
I think he'd be very excited by it, and he would be continuing to encourage people to work in all of these particular areas. I think that the idea of networking technologies, the the web, the next generation of web technologies such as Facebook and Twitter would be of great interest to him. Remember that story I told you a few moments ago about the vision that he had for everyone actually having some sort of cell phone in their pockets. Mm-hmm. I think in many ways one of the things that he was much more aware of was the importance of communications for individuals to interact in a variety of ways. And I think he would be very much pushing that. He'd also tell people to dream, and that's, I think, often what all of these folks that you probably, if we had time to talk mm-hmm. to them about at these companies, would sort of say, yes, that's what Tesla taught us to do, is to dream and to plug into the cultural wishes that people have.
Well, let's take that encouragement. We need to be dreaming and dreaming big right now and dreaming ultimately effectively. Bernie Carlson, W. Bernard Carlson at the University of Virginia, coming out next year with a big biography of Nikola Tesla. It's been great having you with us from Charlottesville today. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom, and I hope that everybody has gotten something out of the show today.
No doubt. In a moment, new product fever in Steve Jobs' Apple country. This is On Point. For weeks now, tech writers have been anticipating Apple's unveiling of a new tablet computing device. The rollout is today. As we go to air, Steve Jobs has not yet spoken, but expectations are high. Joining me now from Seattle to look at those expectations is Scott Steinberg, publisher of the technology product review site DigitalTrends.com. Scott, thanks very much for being here.
Hey, my pleasure, Tom. How are you?
We're great. As Steve Jobs will step to the stage in California and announce what he announces, what's expected, Scott?
What's expected is a lot of game-changing technologies, or at least a lot of excitement surrounding Apple's new digital media strategy for the coming years. We're expected to see maybe a 10-inch, 11-inch digital tablet device, almost like a larger version of the iPhone, that ostensibly may change the future of digital publishing and also the way in which we actually consume on-the-go, on-demand media like TV, movies, digital music, possibly a new face for iTunes, even a cloud computing application that would allow you to access your music anytime, anywhere. So some pretty neat stuff expected.
So by the time some people hear this, we will have seen it. But broadly speaking, what are we talking about physically here? It's something in between, what, an iPhone and a laptop?
Yeah, exactly. It's a touchscreen computing device, so a little bit larger than an iPhone, as you can imagine, more screen real estate, but still that ability to run applications, so these third-party downloadable apps that will be made by a legion of bedroom coders as well as corporations on top of this. Also something that may resemble an e-reader. We've heard it strongly alluded that there's going to be product there from McGraw-Hill, HarperCollins, other publishers. So it could be a real game changer for folks in the publishing industry and may cut e-readers off at the knees, because instead of being a single function device, you're actually going to see a multi-function device that adds an endless array of functionality and makes it easy to play games, to download digital media, to enjoy basically all your favorite multimedia content, as well as access the web and email on the go. And they're actually saying that it may be used as an educational device as well, because it will be so large physically that it will be a device that can be shared by multiple users.
So this would be a competitor for Kindle and the other e-readers on the book front, but there's also some excitement in the magazine, even newspaper publishing world about this.
Yeah, exactly, because it stands the potential to offer a much visually richer reading experience, also the ability to possibly add multimedia interactive features so that you could be downloading streaming audio and video, let's say, while reading a reference manuscript, or also the ability to access more info, more headlines on the go surrounding a given topic. So a lot of excitement there. It's very curious in that you've got a newsstand environment that's not been particularly healthy. And obviously publishers have been looking to devices like the Nook and the Kindle. They've seen some success there, but this could be a real game changer in the fact that it actually adds some of these additional features and doesn't just mimic the ink and paper experience, but actually adds an experience of value.
Now, we can see how it's a step up in the size of display from the iPhone and perhaps in capacity, but what does it offer that, let's say, a laptop wouldn't?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, but I think what it offers is going to be the easy ability to browse and consume this digital content. Obviously, we had MP3 players before we had the iPod, right? But if you look at what iTunes did, it made it very accessible to the masses. So obviously, you have traditional laptop computers, but if we have a touchscreen computing device like this, you may actually have the ability to more easily access virtually every aspect of your digital lifestyle, whether that is communications, whether that is entertainment, whether that is gaming. So hopefully, what it'll do is it'll actually popularize the category. You know, we've had tablet PCs before, right? They've been around for a couple decades.
Yep.
You see them in professional context, but what you haven't seen is a very main only device that anybody could pick up and enjoy.
Now, this is the chatter anyway, is that this might cost $700 or $800. It's pretty expensive, and you'd have to also sign up maybe with AT&T for your wireless service, which I'm reading here could cost another $1,000 every couple years or something like that. Does that sound in the ballpark?
Yeah, it's entirely possible. You know, obviously wireless service would be important, especially since you're looking at a device that could be put at the $800 to $1,000 price mark, which would put it in direct competition with laptops and traditional computing devices. So again, it could be a pricey offer. You know, a lot of people are saying that it's going to be the second coming of the iPhone or the quote-unquote Jesus tablet, and I think that the current price point that we're talking about is going to put it out of the reach of most mainstream consumers, which means it may be a couple years yet until prices fall and the hardware evolves until it really picks up steam and hits critical mass. But again, this is a device that does stand to revolutionize the industry and revolutionize multiple industries at that, because we're also hearing it alluded that you're also going to look at the ability to add digital mobile TV on the go, so you'll be able to download all that content as well as browse ebooks, newspapers, blogs, whatever, but also use it as a computing device. So there should be a lot of value there. But yeah, I definitely think we're going to see a couple of years. It's not going to immediately drop on the market and suddenly be a seismic level event.
Is this one a slam dunk? I mean, just physically, you know. No, it's, you can't put it in your pocket. You've got to maybe, I don't know, have a backpack or something to carry this thing around. People, if you're going to do that, you could take your laptop. Do you think Steve Jobs has a slam dunk in this one, Scott?
Well, I definitely think it's going to be an interesting development. And, you know, whether it's a slam dunk, that comes down to not is it going to be another device that you have to carry, but will it actually replace several that are already in your backpack, briefcase, or carry-on? So if Apple and Steve Jobs can actually deliver a device that makes it very intuitive, very user-friendly to consume this digital media, whether that is books, TV shows, or whatnot, then, yeah, I definitely think they've got another winner on their hands. But just as important is going to be, can they make it, as I pointed out before, accessible, affordable? You got to keep in mind, we're still in the depths of a economy, and a lot of people are looking for convenience and value. And more importantly, the question isn't going to be necessarily whether this one device is a slam dunk, but can Apple generate real excitement behind the category of tablet computing? Because you can bet competitors like Microsoft, HP, Lenovo, these guys aren't waiting on the sidelines idly, and it's going to lead to more innovation, more competitive pricing. So hopefully it's consumers who are going to be the winners in the end.
Apple coming out with its tablet today. Scott Steinberg at digitaltrends.com. Thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.